For years, BreweryDB has been the industry's only professionally curated source of brewery knowledge and responsible for mapping millions of visits to breweries all across the United States. In early 2021, BreweryDB revealed a whole new platform with all new features for craft lovers to plan their unique brewery experience. Find, filter, search, and route your way to breweries worldwide and in your own neighborhood. To take full advantage of the optimized power of BreweryDB and to increase your brew knowledge, visit BreweryDB.com, your digital destination for brewery experiences. Good Beer Matters shares the stories of craft and culture found in every glass, and I'm excited to announce that the Good Beer Matters podcast and BreweryDB are collaborating this year to help you get to the bottom of it. Visit us at BreweryDB.com and GoodBeerMatters.net to finally have the experience you've been missing. My name is Jeremy, and this is Good Beer Matters.
It's an industry of entrepreneurs and definitely do-it-yourselfers, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, some of these things will likely never happen, but, you know, you don't really know. That's a huge one. That is something you definitely want to use an attorney for. And I have heard horror stories of people who basically ended up having to file bankruptcy.
One of the things I love about people in the beer industry is the can-do attitude. To face a new challenge knowing you'll just figure it out takes an unwavering swagger. That being said, there are times when we all need to seek wise counsel. My next guest is an expert who helps her beer clients stay out of legal hot water. I've studied, traveled, and tasted my way through some of the best beer the world has to offer. Over the past few years, I've also spoken to beer industry leaders from around the globe, and one thing is certain, the art, the science, and the culture of beer has more of a profound effect on us than we realize. There's a story of craft and culture found in every glass, and I intend to get to the bottom of it. These are the stories of us, of great food and the beer that brings it all together. I hope you enjoy episode 79 of Good Beer Matters with craft beer attorney, Candace Moon. Welcome back to the Good Beer Matters podcast. This is an episode where I know absolutely nothing about this, so I'm going to spend almost all of my time either asking questions or just shutting up and listening. My next guest is Candace Moon, a beer lawyer. Candace, welcome to Good Beer Matters.
Thank you.
I'm so grateful that you're here, and I'm eager to learn about the legal beer landscape. I'm sure it's very complex as complex as the beers that we enjoy. So, like I said, I'm going to try to just keep my mouth shut most of the episode. But to kick things off, will you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about your history within beer and in beer law?
Sure. My name is Candace Moon. I've been practicing craft beer law for 12 years now, or 11 and a half, almost 12. I went to law school in San Diego, California, obviously a big craft beer city.
Yeah.
And I ended up during law school bartending at a craft beer bar called Hamilton's that is pretty well known in San Diego for being early on in the craft scene. And so that was my real first introduction to craft. And I had gone to law school to do entertainment law. As you know, life happens, I met my husband in law school who said he'd never move to LA. So my ideas of entertainment law kind of went to the side. And, you know, I was still bartending and I'm like, oh, I'll figure it out at some point. And I ended up meeting at a law networking function, a wine lawyer. And it suddenly occurred to me, I'm like, you know, I know all these brewers because all the, you know, the whole industry when, you know, would come into the bar. So I knew a bunch of the local brewers around town and some of the owners. And I'm like, I know all these brewers, but I don't know any beer attorneys. I'll be a beer attorney. So, I mean, I don't mean to say that I made it up by any means because there have been alcoholic beverage attorneys forever. But really kind of my spin on it was I wanted to be, to some extent, the one and only attorney a brewery would need. So rather than just focusing on alcoholic beverage law, which is a whole area of law in and of itself, I basically did a lot of that, a lot of trademark. Trademark's what I really kind of specialized in law school. And then a little bit of everything else. So a little bit of business law, a little bit of employment law, actually a lot of contract law. But again, very similar things to what I had focused on when planning to do entertainment law. And it was funny because I always kind of joke that brewers are a lot like musicians. So when I wanted to do entertainment, I wanted to work with musicians. And it's very, very similar, very creative, very passionate about their craft, not always very business oriented.
And so, and they sometimes dress alike.
Yeah, that's who they are. Sometimes hard to tell the difference.
And so you chose beer law because you're going to be a lawyer of some sort. You liked beer, you knew people, and you wanted to be the only one. So to kind of create a nice little niche, right?
I mean, yes, except I didn't really think of it as creating a niche. I just more was like, oh, I kind of see this need. And I, you know, in focusing on entertainment law, I was already looking at law based on an industry, not law based on an area of law. Necessarily.
Okay.
And so it seemed kind of a natural transition. I'm like, I love these people. I can help them. And I'm like, I'll just, you know, work out of my house. I'll just be me doing my thing, you know, really casual. I had no idea what it was going to kind of blossom into.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I'm very thankful, but I mean, I definitely did not have these like grand plans of like, you know, kind of, you know, being the, well, and I, like I said, I don't think I was the first to do alcohol law by any means, but I do think I was the first to kind of take it as a kind of whole industry in one package practice. So,
well, and
no, I had no idea where things were going to go and how the industry was going to explode, and right place, right time, I think was a lot of it.
And that's perfect. And I can only imagine. So you've been doing this 12 years. And so, you really began right when, craft beer was hitting. It's like really, depending on how you want to measure this, but like a really big, maybe third wave, a big wave.
Exactly.
where craft beer was like, it was present. It wasn't going anywhere. Then all of a sudden it just exploded yet again. Right.
Exactly. Yep.
That's perfect timing. And I think right around that time, we went from maybe a few thousand breweries in the country to now we're getting really darn close to 9,000 breweries in the country. So I bet you're busy.
Very. California alone really has exploded with the number of breweries. So, I mean, the bulk of my clients, you know, my career has kind of had a various trajectory. You know, I started off by myself in my house, just working with California breweries, mostly startups. Then as you know, that kind of grew, I started to hire people, ended up starting my own firm, had four attorneys working for me, kind of took that as far as I could, then went to a national firm where I was working nationwide. I had, I think I want to say like 450 clients when I left the national firm and went back on my own, because I really missed, you know, knowing my clients, you know, with 450, I'm like, who's calling? What do they do? Where are they? What do they need? And I really missed kind of the more personal connection that I had when I first started. So I very much, kind of dwindled my client list to really focus on, California breweries, cause that's my specialty. And I operate as in-house counsel for about 20, 25 California breweries now. And I don't necessarily do everything they need, but I vet everything they need and let them know when we need to bring in, you know, maybe a more experienced attorney in any particular area, especially employment law, which is a really nutty area. And then I kept a bunch of my trademark clients nationwide, just because, you know, when you've worked with people for 10 years, like I can't let go of those folks.
Well, and it's a testament to the beer industry being a relationship business that when you extend it out to law, that you're still holding it as a relationship business.
Mm-hmm. And, very much. It's one of the things I love about it.
Yeah. And so are you working with a certain size brewery or big ones, small ones, nano breweries? What are you doing with?
Actually, when I left my practice, I pretty much just cherry picked, you know, the breweries that I really loved working with, the ones that like brought me in more into what they were doing. But also, so all sizes, but, you know, made good beer, were good clients, and just people I really liked. I mean, and that's not to say that, you know, there weren't people I liked that I didn't bring along with me. But however, the one thing I did realize fairly quickly was I really missed working with startups. So I actually take on a few startups as well. And I run kind of a, roughly a 6-month program for startups. Because at least from the legal perspective, everything they need should be able to be accomplished in a 6-month time frame. So, So I do a little bit of everything still. Especially try to get away from it. Well, like, I'm still just kind of keep my numbers down, though.
Well, and I kind of want to dive in a little bit more depth toward the end of this interview. But you've also kind of written a little guide, right, to kind of help people along the way, because not everyone can or wants to afford you. Or I imagine there's that one guy or gal like, I took a couple classes of law in college. We're good, you know, right?
That is true. Well, you know what? It's an industry of entrepreneurs and definitely do-it-yourselfers. And there is nothing wrong with that. And I try to, when I do speak and talk to people, I try to be very clear about where you can maybe skimp and where you really shouldn't. And I will say this, a lot of it comes down to your risk tolerance, because so much of what a lawyer is going to do is protect you from the worst case scenario. And how often is the worst case scenario really going to happen? Not that often. But I mean, in 12 years, I probably have one example of one client who did the one thing and it totally went sideways for them. Yeah. But again, you know, it's a risk. And you know, some of these things will likely never happen. But, you know, you don't really know.
But it's one of those like an unlikely scenario, but it can just blow up really big if it happens. And so it stands to take a little caution. So kind of getting into the legal issues of beer, we're definitely going to talk about the legal issues when it comes to, brewery owners and that stuff, but that just seems a little too easy to start with. I know you've probably answered all those questions before. So I want to touch my foot on those bases for anyone listening. But the things that I think is kind of interesting is, what are some of the legal issues that might actually kind of affect either directly or indirectly all of us consumers and beer drinkers?
Okay. So, see, this is, you know, these are truly the worst case scenarios that I've been lucky enough not to run into. So and when you say affect consumers, I'm assuming things like exploding cans of beer.
you tell me. I mean, that is a story of that everyone has heard of. Exploding cans of beer is a big pop, but exploding bottles can actually hurt. We've all heard stories of someone died once. But what are all of the issues that we consumers really need to be more cognizant of?
I mean, I think where the consumers really bump into things is going to be, and most of these, and this is why it's like, wait, I work for the breweries. I don't want to tell you like what you can sue them for.
Of course.
But you know, false advertising. You know, there's, you know, you should know what you're buying. Your packaging should tell you the correct ABV, the correct, you know, beverage inside. There shouldn't be any quality issues or product issues. Which is, you know, never 100%, but it, you know, that's really, I think, from a consumer perspective, I guess trademarks could fall into that area, because generally the idea of trademark infringement is, you know, someone using a similar name or a similar look and feel that would make the consumer think the beer came from somewhere else. And it's funny. I actually taught a class last night, and the thing with trademark that I always find so interesting is, from a consumer standpoint, anytime, you know, there's a big case and there's like, oh, infringement, and people go, I wouldn't confuse those two beers. I always point out, it's not about confusing two products. It's about thinking they both come from the same source. So they don't have to be the same. They don't have to, you know, but there has to be something about them that you think that the first company might have made the second product. Because that's what trademark law is concerned about, is confusing consumers, or more so, and I don't really see this in our in the craft beer industry, but deceiving consumers. So, you know, the fake Louis Vuittons, you know, that you see on the street in New York.
So,
you know,
so is it basically like trying to protect branding and intellectual property and like just making sure everyone stays in their own lane type of thing?
Yes. Well, so it's funny. So I always say, too, the law doesn't really care about the companies and the money they've spent on branding and the money they've spent on goodwill. They don't care about the company. They care about the consumer. So if the consumer's not going to be confused, then there really isn't an issue in the law's eyes when it comes to trademarks. But it's a very gray area. Like, you know, who's to say what's confusing? Like, who's to say that one of my favorites was the West 6th and the Magic Hat number 9. And it was the 9 and the 6 with the like fancy circle. And if you really just saw them on a shelf, you might think they were two different numbers in the same series.
Okay.
You know, and that was a pretty big trademark. I just remember like comments on social media. I'm not going to confuse a 6 and a 9.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we get that. But do you think, would you might think the same brewery made both of those beers because it is so similarly looking? And so that's what, and it's also very hard when you're trying to choose a name, especially a brewery name. And I go through this with clients all the time because you're competing against at the trademark office, they consider all alcohol the same. So when you're trying to pick that brewery name, you are up against any and all other breweries and beer names, because a name on beer is a name on beer, whether it's a brewery name or a beer name. Wines, distilled spirits, kombucha, seltzer. So of course it's just getting worse as we get more and more products.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's difficult to find something that hasn't already been used. Because the other big thing to know is that it's not just if you have a registration. If someone has actually sold beer with a name on it, they have trademark rights for that name for beer in the geographic area they've sold it in. So you basically own it where you're known for it. So for, you know, argument's sake, people would own it in the town they've used it in.
Okay.
And that's whether they register or not. And that's a potential liability when you're trying to register a name, because if you try to go into that market, they by law already own the mark there and they can keep you out, you know. And there, you know, definitely comes, and this is where the big companies come into play, a lot of what they call trademark bullying, which is, you know, the big guy who has a lot of money, because people can outspend you, you know, if you can't afford to fight it, or because you have to protect your own mark. So you have to spend the money,
yeah,
you know, to file that lawsuit.
And if you're a small 7-barrel brewery and you can't afford to go up against that mega brewery who,
yep.
And that's another legal issue that, you know, we know exists. It supposedly doesn't occur anymore, but, I guess I'm a little skeptical about, I guess what would be the term? You go in for a land grab when it comes to trademarks or something like that, and someone can just outcompete you.
You can't actually do that in trademarks.
You can.
I mean, you can, but it's technically, it's illegal. And if someone can prove it, then you basically will lose. So you have to file, when you file for a trademark, you're filing an intent to use or an in use. So you're either using it, you're telling trademarks, I am using it, or I have a bona fide intent to use this on products. And you actually can't transfer that trademark to another entity until it has registered. So until you have used it, then you can, you know, transfer to someone, sell to someone. But so I couldn't go in and just file a bunch of trademarks as an intent to use because I'm not using them and then sell them. I'd have to use them first. I mean, people try to do it and, you know, we'll try and fake, you know, everything, but that technically is illegal. And you can definitely, again, you have to pay the money to file at the trademark office to stop them. But the land grab thing doesn't happen in trademark as much as I think people think it does.
Okay.
Or at least there are processes to prevent it, I should say.
Well, and that's where, you know, slightly off topic, but the whole idea of just gobbling up different potentially valuable, what do you call them? URLs.
Domain names.
Yeah, yep. Domain names. Yeah. If my brewery is jaresgreatbrewery.com and you come in and buy jaresgreatbrewery.net, well, I'm kind of hosed and everything around it. And I may not be able to spend the money to do that. Is there any protection in a kind of situations like those without having fight?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, you're going to have to fight for it. You're going to have to, you know, spend the money to defend your rights. But especially if you can prove, let's say, bad intent and that they purposely did it to basically force you to buy it from them, you can probably get attorney fees. Now, granted, you have to spend it to then get it back. Gotcha. When you win. And of course, when you win, you have to hope they have the money. to pay you, you know, those attorney fees. So, I mean, money is still a big factor in any kind of litigation, which is one of the reasons, I mean, I am a huge fan of not going to litigation. It is, no one wins in litigation but lawyers. That's what I always say. Like, because you're going to spend so much money, and most people settle for what they could have settled for in the first place, but they just get to a pain threshold, either a financial or a stress pain threshold, and they settle, which is what they could have done way back when everyone was pissed off and emotional and couldn't make a business decision. Wow. And I personally believe that in virtually all areas of litigation. And I think, you know, again, unless you're like a huge company and you have a ton of money, you know, nobody's going to win.
Yeah. And of course, there are those people that sue others for sport and God forbid. But that's a different topic. There was a court case that came through a few years ago. I'll keep the names out, but someone sued a big beer company for saying that, for making it appear that they were brewed in one place when they were actually brewed somewhere else.
Yeah.
And to me, I was thinking, well, okay, I guess that makes sense. But I didn't quite understand, however I felt about the beer company, the lawsuit, whatever it is, totally irrelevant. I didn't quite understand how that affects the consumer.
Because you're being deceived.
I've got a question for you. How are you engaging with your customers? Are you adding value or just vying for attention? If you have a business, then you are an authority and should be regarded as a partner in everyone's mutual success. But getting that message across in the first place, that's the trick. At Mountain Sea Media, I use education and storytelling to keep your brand on top of mind. So if you're done with ineffective marketing and want to create more impact, I want Mountain Sea Media to be your resource for high-value branded content. Contact me at jeremy@mountainseamedia.com to explore the possibilities. After all, it's your story. I'll help you tell it.
I mean, if their whole brand is all about, and I'm just going to make up, I don't know, Pittsburgh. So let's, you know, we're the common man and we're born and raised in Pittsburgh, and basically anything they do to get you to buy it because they're telling you it's from Pittsburgh and then it's not from Pittsburgh, that's deceptive. I mean, they're basically, you know, that's kind of a bait and switch. And I think that's what it comes down to is not so much that, you know, the small print on the back said brewed, you know, and canned in Pittsburgh, but when you're totally promoting a brand to have a certain story and a certain background, to the point that you were, you know, hoping that people will buy it because of the story in the background, and then that's not true, that's deceptive.
Okay, perfect. It's just one of those things where it doesn't affect the quality or the flavor of the beer. It to me, that just kind of had to deal with telling a story that just wasn't true. And it's kind of funny. When I wrap my head around that, when the boots, you know, meet the ground, it's just kind of like, well, it's the same beer, so who cares? And I've heard people make that argument. Who cares? But being a storyteller and doing what I do, it's like, no, that's important. If you're going to enamor someone with the story of the beer, of the promise of the experience, and it's just, you know, that's not right.
Well, it's like there was a big lawsuit, which, I mean, it was one of those things I kind of knew how it was going to go, but where, and I think it might've been a class action, and I can't remember which big beer company was sued, but for calling their beer craft.
Oh.
When they weren't quote unquote craft. And I mean, I was asked about the suit at the time, and I'm like, well, I'm not sure there's a legal definition of the word craft. And that's, I think, where you're going to fall apart. But I mean, again, the idea was, you know, are you deceiving people? You know, is there this general understanding of what craft means? And you're not doing that. And I know there was one for liquor too.
Mm.
I think that was Tito's for some reason, the liquor one. Mm. But I have to admit, I don't follow spirits quite as much as the beer stuff. Plus, I swear the pandemic, I think it's just like wiped. It's like I was like lost a year and a half.
Oh, no.
You know, like all the things I used to talk about on a regular basis. I'm like, oh. Oh yeah. Forgot there was a world out there where things happened.
Yeah, I love that new commercial. Granted, it's from a big beer company, but it's like, you know, we have to learn how to go outside of our house again, and it's clever, and partially it's kind of true. So in a previous episode of the Good Beer Matters podcast, we talked to a member of the European Beer Consumers Union, and basically we just discussed why you would have a union for beer consumers and what are the issues, and it all has to do with stuff that we've already just talked about. But is there anything like that in the U.S. and if not, should there be?
You know, I don't think there is. I mean, I know that there are certain certifications you can't put on beer or alcohol without having gotten, you know, like gluten-free and organic. Like there, you have to go through certain tests and companies to be able to put that certification on your product. But yeah, I actually don't know anything. But again, I think we have a bunch of laws that already maybe do the same thing, or at least are supposed to. Because I mean, it's amazing. And I definitely don't know what it's like in Europe, but the number of regulations anyone in the alcohol industry has to follow is so overwhelming. It amazes me that we have mom and pop businesses in a highly regulated industry. It's kind of why I have a job.
So. Well, yeah. Yeah. Cause there's just so much to deal with that. It's just overwhelming. So,
yeah.
I'm just amazed that we continue to grow more breweries. Let's kind of launch into that mom and pop brewery. Let's say you and I open up, Jer Moon Brewery or something like that. I'll just make it up on the spot. And it's just, you know, we're partners in this thing, but it's just real small. I mean, you know, we aspire to brew 7 barrels at a time someday. What are the first wave of legal issues that we need to be aware of when we're just starting and we're small?
Well, are we open?
Let's say we're preparing to open.
Okay. So we need to create a business entity, because we want to protect our personal assets from anything that could happen to the business, especially because a business involving alcohol is going to have more potential liabilities than a regular business. So I definitely don't recommend being a sole proprietor. And even if you think you want to start as a sole proprietor and then, you know, as I get bigger, I'll switch to an entity. If you do that and you do your licensing as a sole proprietor, you have to do your licensing all over again. And you definitely don't want to have to do that. That's a lot of paperwork.
And would anyone ever create a brewery under a sole proprietorship?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Wow. Okay.
not my client. But, and again, I mean, and you know what? It never came back to bite them. But
wow.
Okay. But that's just it. You're taking a chance and you're taking a risk. But at the same time, like, I guess if you don't own anything as a sole prop, you don't really have anything to lose. So, I mean, that's also the way to look at it.
I would just be concerned that, you know, of course, someone drinks too much at the tap room and then they go out and cause an accident and everything comes back. And it's just like, if I were a sole proprietor in that situation, I'd just be like, wow, that everything's done.
No. Yeah. No, very true. But I guess what I'm saying is as an individual, if you don't own a home and maybe you don't own a car, like if you have nothing, they can sue you. But what are they going to get? I mean, you'll file bankruptcy, but there's nothing to take. So that's, I mean, I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm just saying that I think there's, you know, people who are like, well, you know, and that is what you run into. Like there is no, and this is why companies get sued. Because sometimes there's no point in suing the individual. Because why would you sue someone who has no money? You know, it's like you can't get blood from a stone.
Yeah.
So you go after who has the money, and that also might have some responsibility, obviously. But
so what I hear you saying is, if I were to start a brewery under sole proprietorship, make sure I have absolutely zero assets when I start.
Pretty much. Well, because, I mean, the business may have assets, and that's what you'll lose. But you would lose that if you had an entity anyway, because those assets belong to the business.
Yeah.
But if you have nothing to lose, but keep in mind, at some point you may have something to lose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, someday I may buy a house. Someday I may have a car.
Exactly.
And I may have, you know, a guitar signed by Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, that's certainly an asset. So.
God forbid you lose that.
God forbid we lose that.
Exactly.
So after kind of starting the whole business licensing, if we're a small brewery just trying to get started, what would be the next steps that we need to, the next things that we need to be aware of?
So we have our business entity. You definitely want to get your lease reviewed. That's a huge one. That is something you definitely want to use an attorney for. And I have heard horror stories of people who signed their leases, never anyone reviewed it, and basically ended up having to file bankruptcy. I won't go into the long explanation, but your lease review is hugely important. And a lot of people skip it because it's expensive, because leases are very long, but it's very important. So we review the lease. Once we have the lease, we can start the licensing, because you can't start your licensing until you have a signed lease. We start the licensing, and then at that point, we're dealing with construction, getting the place fixed up, tenant improvements, all that kind of stuff. And then we're signing hops contracts, malt contracts. Again, that's something that not a lot of people get reviewed. And, you know, again, I never even saw a hops contract until people were trying to get out of them, which is usually when it's a lot harder to do anything at that point. But getting all water supplies.
Is that
equipment.
What kept you busy during the pandemic, is people trying to get out of hop contracts?
A little bit. That and trying to quickly identify the daily changing regulations of how you're allowed to operate or not operate during COVID. That was a huge thing, and how to deal with your employees and, you know, the different sick leaves that were available. And yeah, that was definitely, the pandemic had a whole lot more than one would have expected. Certainly more than I expected, to see, but once you do your licensing and you get open, at that point, you're just really worried about your compliance with your state alcohol laws and the federal. So filing your brewing report of operations, filing your excise taxes, making sure you're not violating state ABC laws. So, you know, how you're allowed to deal with retailers, what you can and can't do. A lot of states have brand registration, price posting, you know, and just being aware of all those regulations, you know, and you know, starting to build your following and your business.
I got a bug bite in my hair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you hear that?
I did. That was fantastic.
We can go back if you like.
Oh, no, I got to keep that in. That's just beautiful. So let's say the brewery that you and I both started, we're open. We've been operating for a little while. You know, we've got all that opening things up behind us. What are some of the issues that a small but operating brewery needs to start thinking about now?
Well, certainly as you have more employees, you'll have more employee issues. And at least in California, there are different policies and different laws you have to follow that kick in at different numbers of employees. So when you have like two or three, there's not a lot you need to do. But when you hit five, there's certain things that go into play. And then you hit 10 and certain things go into play. So you kind of have to be aware of your state and what's going on as you grow your staff. And then of course your, you know, staff in and of itself has its own fun liabilities. My favorite story, I have to say this one. This was years ago, and it was a restaurant, it was a brewery with a restaurant. And apparently the chef had brought in, and this was pre-legal CBD or legal marijuana. The chef had brought in some pot brownies and put them in the fridge, not for general consumption, but yet then they were generally consumed.
Then they were distributed.
And they didn't know what to do. Only in this, you know, industry.
Yeah.
And I honestly, this was when my employment law attorney handled it. So I actually don't know the answer to what you do in that situation, but she knew and she handled it. But
I would imagine, the first reaction from the brewers might be, "You're welcome."
Exactly.
but depending on the guests who arrived that day.
Exactly. But so employee issues are always a big one. But then you're also going to start to think about where do you want to go? And that's what I have to remind people a lot, is that it's very easy to get bogged down in the day-to-day and the, you know, we need to brew this much beer. We have this much demand. We need to brew more. We need to do this. And trying to just keep all the details and keep all the pieces moving. But you never want to forget about the big picture. So as you know, and not only like, where are we going? Where do you want to go? You know, because I remember having, this was a prospect call, and they're like, you know, we've been open, we keep selling out of our beer. So, you know, what do? How do we grow? I'm like, well, how do you want to grow? I mean, you know, if you keep selling out, you could just stay the same and raise the price. You know, I'm just like, you make more money. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you can build a new facility, or you can contract brew and have someone else brew more beer for you. And, you know, do you want to enlarge your tap room and have more people on site? Do you want to have more beer to distribute? You know, there's different ways of getting places, but where do you want to go is kind of the big question. And then how do you get there? Because there's always a way to get there pretty much. Well, not always, I guess, but you got to figure out what it is you want first. And always be aware that what you think you want may not be what you really want. As I have a number of brewers who, professional brewers who open their own breweries, and are kind of like, I don't ever get to brew anymore. Why did I do this? I'm like, yep, that's because you're now a brewery owner and you don't get to brew. I mean, until you get big enough and have enough money to pay people to do the business side of things, and then you can go back to brewing, you know?
Yeah.
But there's just so much more to it than just brewing. So.
So as breweries get bigger, and as they do grow and they go from that small to that bigger, maybe it's a statewide, regional, to a large national brewery, you know, how much of the legal landscape changes as you get bigger?
Oh, well, I'll say this, as especially during the pandemic, when people were looking for additional sources of revenue and everyone was starting to look at, you know, can I ship direct out of state? Or even just opportunities to distribute out of state, since, you know, people were buying beer at grocery stores, but, you know, nobody was going out anywhere. The minute you want to go into a new state, there is so much you need to understand and to know that I would almost recommend anyone wanting to go national should have an in-house, if not an attorney, you know, a compliance person who understands the legalities and the paperwork of every different state, because I recently took on during the pandemic, and partly because I was expecting to lose business, I took on a client who was looking to go national and basically needed help doing the paperwork in every state. And oh my God, I kind of wish I hadn't said yes. I mean, it's been an amazing learning experience in a lot of ways. But it's also a reminder of like, oh my God, but you're dealing with government. So nothing's easy. And God forbid you don't cross a T, you know, they're kicking it back and trying to do 50 states at one time. And they're all different. And trying to, like, you know, navigate all of that is very overwhelming. And there are actually companies that will do it for you now. I mean, you know, somebody saw an opportunity and good on them. But so as you get bigger, your legal landscape just gets more and more complicated, because now you're having to deal with all these other states and either their beer franchise laws and your distribution agreements and the relationships with your distributors. But if you have a sales rep in another state, now you got to deal with employment laws in that state because that person lives there. And so you've got to adhere to that state's laws for that person, sick leave. And also all the things, you know, for your state, you now have to learn for another state and make sure that that person is treated correctly and legally. And then, you know, again, it just, and then the bigger you are, the more employees you have, you definitely have more issues. I mean, I would say actually employees is your biggest potential litigation area. At least the people most of the stuff I've dealt with has either been trademark infringement or employees, you know, former employees suing, or I should say this, attempting to sue or threatening to sue the employer.
And so I have known and worked for some of those employers who I'm surprised that they aren't sued more often. Is that something that that usually doesn't end up going anywhere?
Well, you know, the thing is the ones that and maybe this is also because I've been very picky about the clients I'm working with. I have been fortunate enough that the ones I've seen were fairly baseless. I think in my career, and this is back actually when I was at the firm and had the 450 clients, there were definitely a couple of people that were sued and that, you know, were very likely guilty. I mean, I don't know the specifics, you know, and all those things end up settling. But I mean, it just kind of depends on the people involved and who's willing to do what and the advice that they get and the attorneys they work with. I mean, one of the reasons you see a lot of employment lawsuits is there are a lot of employment attorneys, plaintiff side, which would be for the employee to sue the employer, that take cases on contingency. So the employee, or the former employee, doesn't have to pay anything right away. And the attorney takes, you know, X percent of whatever they happen to get from the employer.
Gotcha.
Whether that's in a settlement or whether in an actual case.
And so if they get nothing, then the former employee
then the attorney gets nothing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And that attorney gets nothing. So hopefully, so the idea of there also being that if there's really nothing there, that attorney's not going to take it on. But like, so, and this is what I've seen, but you know, they only hear the one side of the story. So former employee comes in and says, oh, I was totally, you know, I didn't get my meal breaks. I didn't get this. I didn't get paid correctly. All those kind of things. And then, you know, I get this huge long letter from the attorney of all the claims. But we have documentation of like, well, here's where they signed a meal waiver and here's where they checked out. Here's where they signed the employee handbook saying if they weren't getting their meals, they had to tell somebody and they never told anyone. And so the more, you know, it's here, like, here's my complete refute of what this person has told you. And then if I don't hear from them again, I know that like, okay, yeah, that wasn't really, you know, again, they're only hearing one side of the story. Now, at the same time, I do think, especially very topical as of if you've been on Instagram or Twitter the last couple of days, there are a whole lot of things that have not been litigated, but probably should have been. But again, I think there's a big fear in general of, you know, bringing a lawsuit against an employer in an industry that you want to keep working in.
Mm.
And I think that's true across all industries. That's certainly not specific to craft beer. You don't want to get blacklisted. Like, oh, you know, don't hire that person. They're going to sue you if you do XYZ. There's a lot of problems in the industry, but it's funny, although specifically what's been brought up recently is specific to craft. I've seen it because before I went to law school, I was in the music business. And before that, I was in computer software. And I've seen it in every industry. Just, discrimination.
Are we talking about sexual harassment and
yes.
Some of those things?
Yeah. Yes, we are. Sorry, I was being a little vague. And I forget that we're not live. So.
Well, and honestly, you know, Grant, I know there are gray areas there, too. And there's, you know... it's not a simple thing, or it may not be a simple thing. But you know, since we're on this thread, it's kind of interesting. What are besides the obvious things that we already should know about? What are some of the things that, if an employee is truly wronged, what should he or she seek counsel for, as opposed to those things that you know it's not going to go anywhere. Just go find a new job. And along with that, how can breweries or craft beer companies do better to prevent this?
Okay, that was a lot of questions in one.
Yes.
So I'm going to start actually with the last question. So what you really want to do as an employer is very much encourage your employees to tell you what's going on. And to file a complaint, ideally not to complain to a coworker, but to actually come to a manager, somebody in charge, and say, look, you know, I don't mean to make waves, but this makes me really uncomfortable. I mean, you don't have to be a jerk about it, but you also say something. And if you see something, let's say you're an employee, you see someone else getting harassed or discriminated, say something to somebody, because then the company has to investigate. And that's where the stuff can be kind of uncovered. Where companies get in trouble, and I vividly remember this from the first company I worked for, is someone would complain about a manager and that manager just gets transferred. Like that's not, no. You know, you don't just shift the problem. You have to actually address it, and you want to bring in an independent person. So let's say if I'm the general counsel or company, I would hire, you know, an independent employment, either consultant or attorney to come in and do an investigation, and they will talk to people, find out what's going on, or hopefully at least find out what the general consensus is, and then make recommendations. And, you know, be aware of your workplace. And I mean, and here's the thing, I think that, and maybe it's just, I want to think this because I do love this industry, is that, you know, you like the people you work with. You don't want to make someone uncomfortable. You're not trying to make someone comfortable, hopefully. And if you know they're uncomfortable, hopefully you'll stop doing it. You know, that's kind of how I look at it. I think a lot of it can be chalked up to ignorance, not realizing, and nobody telling them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that at least. I mean, I know that I've been guilty of it. And as soon as one tells me, I'm like, what? Oh my God, I'm so sorry. That is not what I meant. And, you know, and then you make the effort not to do it again if it makes them uncomfortable. But at the same time, especially what's, you know, been just come out in the last couple of days of these like anonymous stories is over the top, blatant sexual discrimination. And I should actually, not even discrimination, harassment, in the sense that, and I think part of it in this industry, which makes it a little worse, is there are a lot of events that we go to and things that we work at where we're drinking. And I don't mean like during the day, like, but like we go to festivals,
mm-hmm.
we work festivals, we go to conferences, and there is a lot of alcohol, which definitely lowers inhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying it excuses anything. I think it just explains why it might be more prevalent. And then I think people are confused, certainly, you know, and I say this as someone in the older generation, you know, there's certain things that I grew up thinking were acceptable that aren't acceptable now. And I need to know that and be responsible for knowing that. You know, things that probably should bother me that don't, because mm-hmm. I'm just so used to it. But, you know, as men or women, we need to, we live in today's society, in today's world, and we need to pay attention that, yeah, it might have been okay when we were young, but it's not okay now.
Yeah.
And like but in the so 70s, we're informed, you know, we don't know. You know?
Well, and like I remember the 70s, there were a lot of things, even movies you go back and watch in the 70s, 80s, and even the 90s, where mm-hmm. you watch that movie and it's just like, that is how it was back then. How did we get away with that? How was that tolerated?
Okay.
How was that accepted as normal? But it was. And it doesn't mean it's okay. It's just that's how things were then. And it's, thank goodness we're trying to evolve.
Yes. Yes, completely. So as an employer, be aware, very much, you know, make your employees comfortable telling you what's going on and then do something about it. You know, if it's, you know, and that doesn't mean you have to fire someone on the spot, depending on what it was, but you write them up, you explain to them why they shouldn't do that. And if they do it again, you know, then you let them go, you know, or, you know, it's, and I think that's one of the hardest things I've seen is people don't want to fire people. And I'll admit, like, I hate having, like, I am not good at that. Like, I would never be like, I've already determined if I ever have employees again, I don't want employees again. And if I do, I don't want to be in charge of them. Because I am not good at it. And I think a lot of people in this industry aren't, and they don't want to fire people, even when that person is clearly not a good fit, clearly not working out. And I think that's where people get in a lot of trouble too. And then as, you know, as employees, I mean, yeah, you have the right to not feel uncomfortable at work. I think that's the key to harassment, is things that make you feel uncomfortable. And I think that's why, because, and I think in any industry where, or really any situation where the majority of the people have one, I don't know, sense of humor, one, you know, have a lot in common that they have, that everyone else on the outskirts feels a little like they don't fit in, they don't belong, but I, you know, I need to try to fit in, you know, that's where you're going to have more issues. And I think because the industry is pretty heavily white male dominant, you know, taking those extra, again, just keeping your eyes open, keep your ears open. And education. Again, I think I like to think that's a big part of it. The people are not purposely, you know, harassing people. But I also do think, and again, with the generational thing, I think there's a lot of confusion as to what is considered, you know, harassment versus, oh, I was just complimenting someone, or, you know, especially with gender roles, like it is a confusing time in some ways. But, you know, again, education, I think that would be huge.
Yeah, I'm a
I mean,
big,
I don't have a good answer.
Well, you know, no, and that's okay. I'm a huge proponent of education, and I lean more toward understanding beer flavor, beer style, beer food pairing, whatever it is. But that's why I wanted to bring you onto the podcast, just because we need to have a better understanding of law. We need to have a better understanding of how to avoid legal issues. We need a better understanding of how to, you know, just wake up in the morning and remind ourselves, don't be a jerk, don't be a jerk, don't be a jerk. But that means something different to everybody.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If we're honest, and so we have to at least put out the effort to understand that different definition by other people's standards, so that we can make our work environment as diverse as the beer industry is in the, uh-huh. to begin with.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Right?
Yep.
Good. Maybe I should be a beer lawyer. No, that'd be a bad day.
You could definitely be a mediator. I don't know if you want to go to law school. But.
So as we kind of begin to wind down, I want to hear, you and I chatted about this before, and I saw that it finally came out on LinkedIn, but you have a new website called starterbrewery.com, right?
I do.
Tell me.
Well, I shouldn't say I.
Tell us about that.
Okay. So it's kind of funny because it was a really random, I got one of those random emails during the pandemic of like, I have this URL. Would you like to buy it? And I'm like, starterbrewery.com. You know, I'm not really looking to grow my business at this point. I'm feeling pretty good. But then I started thinking about some of the consultants that I work with, the providers that I work with and that I speak with and teach with. And I'm like, you know, maybe there is something here. And another consultant that I've known for years, Laura Lodge, who's also been very big in educating both brewing industry folks as well as consumers, was like, oh my God. And, you know, she's like, this is what we need to do. And between the two of us, we basically have crafted a website that is for people looking to start a brewery. It is basically all the consultants and industry folks that we know and the different presentations that we've done, articles we've written, resources that we have that everyone has been willing to share are up on the site. And it's basically a repository of information that's it's divided up. We've divided it a few different ways. We kind of broke the whole opening a brewery down into kind of four parts, which is plan, act, open, and grow. And so we've kind of split everything into that. And then we split everything by marketing, ingredients, equipment, legal, business plan, consultants, finance. You know, we've kind of split all the different areas as much as we could kind of think of as well. So each of those areas has a page, and we're taking, we're open to contributions from anyone. Right now it's, you know, the people we've known and that we've worked with. So we know the quality is there and the knowledge and experience. But looking to kind of the two things we've looked at in terms of the next step is having brewers, you know, who are interested in sharing their stories and their experiences participate. And then definitely, and this is definitely kind of what I want to do for the next one, is having a forum or a, you know, whether it's a listserv or whatever, where people can ask questions and get answers from, you know, other startups or consultants or, you know, brewers, you know, whoever's, you know, following along. But it is set up to be free for anyone who wants to access it. Hopefully we'll get enough advertising to pay to run it.
Yeah.
So far so good, you know.
But that sounds like an incredible resource for people who it seems like there's plenty of people opening businesses now and take advantage of the kind of an open field, if you will, but to do it in a way that's sustainable would be spectacular. So that's great you're putting that out.
Yeah, it's been up live for I think a week and a half. We just did a press conference the other day, and so I definitely www.startabrewery.com. Go check it out, and you know, any feedback we would love to hear. You know, we did, you know, we both, Laura and I, have, you know, friends who are starting breweries, so you know, we pulled them in to get some feedback of, again, how to arrange it, how to make it easy to figure out. To either, if you don't know at all where to start, how to figure out where to start, or if you know exactly what you want to find out about, how you can find that as well. Hmm. So hopefully we've met both those criteria. But yeah, it's exciting. Like, you know, and again, both of us have been so into educating, you know, people starting breweries that it's like, it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, it's the whole reason I wrote a book. You know, I'd be like, I'm saying the same thing over and over again. Why not just write it down and then people can have it, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, a book is a little different, like, since it's a physical thing, I'm like, I have to charge people for it because I have costs. But a website, you know, if we can cover our costs with advertising, we can offer this for free, you know, we can just put it out there. And anybody, you know, that wouldn't normally have access or wouldn't even necessarily know where to go, hopefully we'll stumble across it and find the information that they want.
Perfect. And I was going to ask you about your book as well. What's the name of the book?
Oh, Brew Law 101, a legal guide to opening a brewery in California. So it is specific to California. But at the same time, I mean, you know, every state has their own laws, but you know, things correlate. So, and the one thing I will say, it is written for the layperson. It is not written for attorneys. I always feel bad when an attorney buys it. I'm like, I'm not sure this is what you think it's going to be. and I actually should probably update it. And I just haven't had the time because I put it out six, seven years ago.
Okay. Yeah.
But I'd say 75% of it is still the same. It's just some of the, you know, very specific laws have changed. So I definitely wouldn't use it as a Bible by any means, but, I think it's still a pretty good resource.
Well, and you know, maybe it provides the role of just being like a checklist or think about this and then dive in deeper for the details of your specific, that seems like the way to go.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, and it's funny that you say that because the end of every chapter has a checklist.
Oh, great.
And then actually, and all those checklists are now available on startabrewery.com.
Two resources right there. Perfect. Perfect. So as we wind down, I've got a series of questions for you. What do you wish more people knew about law in the beer industry?
Let's see. That's a tough one. That, you know, and I actually think that most of my clients do know this, but that the law is not something to try and get around. 9 times out of 10, there is a good reason the law is that way. So I've definitely told a lot of clients, and I've probably lost some people for this, but I'm like, I'm not the attorney you call when you want to figure out how to get around the law. So
perfect. Sounds like that could be a completely separate episode of how to avoid the law. It sounds like there's a bunch of 80s TV shows based upon that premise. If you could be the queen of the beer world for a day, what would you change?
Oh. Okay, so this is one of those things, it's like a Miss America question where I should wish for like world peace. and I'm going to wish for more sour breweries.
More sour breweries. Well, queen of the beer world, you can have whatever you want.
Can I have multiple?
One in each corner. We'll replace all the Starbucks with sour breweries.
Oh,
and to kind of tag on to that, I think I know where your next answer is going to go, but if you could choose your very last meal and your very last beer before you depart this earth, what would they be?
Well, the sad thing is I'm not sure the meal and the beer are going to pair very well. But the beer would definitely be Russian River Beatification.
Mm.
I love that beer. And my last meal, though, would probably be, because I am a Southern girl at heart, fried chicken, mashed potatoes and gravy and biscuits. like I said, I'm not sure it's a great pairing, but it is like all my favorite things.
Well, it, as long as it takes you to that happy place, then that's a great pairing. And with all of your experiences, however you kind of accumulate them, in your opinion, why does good beer matter?
It makes life worth living.
Simple. That is probably the most concise answer I've had thus far. And that's fantastic. If anyone listening wants to connect with you for legal advice or connect with you for whatever, where can they go to find you?
Craftbeerattorney.com. So, and so if anyone does want to connect with questions, I always, and I still, 12 years later, do free consultations. So there's a form you can fill out on the website that comes to me or my assistant, because I did actually just recently hire an assistant. And we'll get back to you and find out. And generally, if I don't know the answer, I know someone who does and can forward you on to someone. So there's a number of craft beer attorneys around the country now, which is pretty awesome. And a lot of us know each other because we've grown up together and see each other at the conferences. So there's a lot of folks out there to help. And hopefully you'll find some of them on startabrewery.com. If I can get them to take some time and donate some information as well.
That would be fantastic. And last question, do you have a call to action or final words of wisdom for the listeners?
You're going to laugh when I say this, but don't open a brewery.
Oh, that's probably more profound than we might think it is on surface level. I mean, there's so many breweries out there right now. It's a good problem if you're a consumer, but it's also becoming a challenge.
Well, I think too that a lot of people are very attracted to it, or they love to homebrew, and they just don't realize how difficult it is. And I always joke when I teach that my job is to talk people out of opening a brewery. Because if I can't talk you out of it, then you'll probably do okay.
Yeah, excellent. That's an interesting way to vet people out of that. Perfect.
Well, and I've definitely seen a lot of people come and go, like the people who are like, oh, I'm retiring, I'm going to open a brewery. I'm like, oh God. That's a 2 to 3 year, maybe that'll last that long. This is not a good retirement plan.
Yeah.
Unless you're really rich and can afford to pay people to do all the stuff you don't want to do.
Oh yeah, I knew a guy who essentially did that, and he's working and he had a great job and was able to retire early, probably 50 or something like that, and decided to start a brewery for a second career. And he's working harder now than he did before he retired. And it's just I always wonder, did that work out for you? But
well, you know, again, I tell people, like, you don't open a brewery to make money. You can totally make a living, but you open a brewery because you love brewing beer, or you love beer, because you're not going to, nobody is ever going to get $1 billion for their brewery again. And, you know, I even tell them, like, do not look for investors who are looking for a true return on their investment.
Yeah. They just need free beer.
Yeah. And to be able to say they own a brewery.
Yeah. Candace, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast and for sharing your knowledge about legal issues. I really hope people get a lot out of this.
I do too. And thanks for having me. This was fun.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
Beer law can be as complex as the beers it represents. I'm certainly no expert, but one thing I know is that if the worst case scenario can catastrophically affect your life and livelihood, it's better to have someone like Candace on your team. In the next episode, we talk to the man who wrote the Bible on beer to learn why some breweries thrive while others fail. Good Beer Matters is a show about great beer, great friends, and the experiences we create together. But it's also about better beer education so you can level up your game. So if you're a beer and food professional or even a beer enthusiast, then please subscribe to Good Beer Matters podcast and go to goodbeermatters.net for more resources and next steps. After that, grab a beer, hang out with friends, and let the world open up. Thank you for listening. Cheers.